Welcome to Credit Exchange, your podcast for all things credit, where we speak to the biggest newsmakers and news shapers in finance. I'm your host, Lisa Lee. This week, my guest is Greg Peters, co-chief investment officer at PGIM Fixed Income, an asset manager with nearly a trillion in AUM. Welcome to the podcast, Greg.
Thanks for having me, Lisa. Great to be here.
Greg, I want to start this week with the big macro picture. Spotlight governments. Right now, as we tape this podcast on Tuesday, the fate of the French government is uncertain. The UK government is looking at a huge fiscal hole and worries about bond vigilante. In the US, the government is shut down, which may not have much impact on the economic picture, but certainly is indicative about this political chaos recently. As an investor, Greg, how do you factor all of these things in?
Yeah, it's a great question, Lisa. I think markets are really struggling with the near-term effects versus the longer-term kind of structural unmooring effects. France is a great example, emblematic in many different ways. You know, arguably, France has been running, you know, pretty large deficits for quite some time. Often the running joke was that it looked more like a peripheral European country than a core, but at the same time received credit as being a core European country. What started to occur over the summer and continues into today is when you're running such large deficits, when the fiscal is as fragile as France, the political system matters, right? And I think this is very much of a canary in a coal mine as well. So when the markets got a whiff of the political system unraveling to a degree, I don't want to be overly dramatic about it, but at the same time, you know, definitely, you know, political dissension and the inability to operate as a government, bond markets pay attention. And that's precisely what's occurred as you look at just the fortunes of France versus Italy. And the two have really moved in opposite directions. So I look at France as very much what happens to a sovereign that's over-indebted, where the political system is called into question.
In the U.S., the political system is not in question, even though the government is shut down temporarily. But we are looking at a Federal Reserve that is cutting interest rates, its policy rate, into what could be a growing economy. Are you worried at all about overheating of the U.S. economy? And when you make investments into the U.S., is that a worry for you?
Yeah, so that's a more complicated answer, I would say. So you have several factors going on in the U.S. And once again, you have a near-term versus longer-term issue going on. First and foremost, I think many investors, particularly those looking outside the U.S., are scratching their head and wondering why the U.S. risk markets are doing so well. And I think this is a lesson that we've seen, you know, many times over history, where, you know, markets aren't guardrails, right? They're not the guardrails that you're looking for around, let's say, the fraying of institutional norms. You mentioned, you know, the independence of the Federal Reserve. You have, you know, some other issues at play, you know, here in the U.S. You know, these things take time, right? And, you know, markets aren't morality plays. And so what markets do is that they focus on the near term. And the near term has been pretty strong fundamentally. You know, you look at cash flows of the companies that we invest in, or just more broadly, you have seen some weakening in the overall macro, but by and large, it's been really quite strong. So the backdrop fundamentally is pretty solid, even with some of these questionable issues around government function and geopolitics. And that gets us to the overheating, right? So as you focus on 2026, yes, it's 2026 time as it's, you know, in October, our probability of overheating is at 25%, and it's higher than a recession probability. You look at 2026, you have fiscal stimulus coming through. You have probably a more, you know, easy Fed and put those things together with deregulation and some other factors, there's this real risk of overheating in 2026. There's also, though, a potential, we have a 10% probability of this productivity boost.
AI and NVIDIA and so forth?
Exactly. And so this is some real spending going on, and we can talk more about it in a bit when we think about, you know, how we're investing. But the amount that, you know, the U.S. is spending on data centers, so infrastructure CapEx as a percent of GDP is about 1.2%. That's more than the telecom of 2020. You know, 1999, 2020, that was at 1%, and not quite rivaling the railroads at 6% in the, you know, 1880s, but it's a very, very big spend, and it's really driving GDP growth, right? So half of first half of GDP is driven by investment in data centers. So it's a very big spend, and you put that all together, and there's a real potential for an overheating scenario in 2026. And overheating also means more inflation as well.
I know. When we started this year, I thought that inflation was sort of contained and maybe we'd won the inflation game. But it seems like inflation is rearing its head again, not just in the US, but also in the UK. It's becoming more stubborn. And governments seem as though they want to write checks and not cut back on spending in any way. Given that there's so many inflationary pressures around the world, where do you invest then?
Yeah, so inflation, what we learned post-COVID is that it's really tough to hide out in a high inflationary environment, right? It's just it just erodes all types of financial assets, including risk assets on the equity side, but definitely on the fixed income side. So there's not, a great way to hedge oneself in a broad inflationary type of realm. At the same time, inflation is not created equal. It's not equal globally. You are seeing disinflation in other parts of the globe, namely China. China looks pretty interesting from a, you know, a disinflationary hedge perspective. Parts of Europe are seeing kind of disinflation or less inflation. But in the U.S., and you mentioned the U.K., you know, those are areas that, continue to battle inflation. And my suspicion is inflation is going to continue to be quite sticky, particularly in the U.S. as the tariff policy continues to be rolled out. It's an open question, of course, with the Supreme Court rulings, but you know the bias is for more tariff, not less, you know, affecting the economy. So, yeah, inflation, I think, is here to stay, but it's not meted out equally. And what I think it does is it forces investors outside the U.S., and to be broadly diversified. And that includes Europe, that includes China, and other parts of EM.
So since I have you with me and we're talking about macroeconomics, I think the flip side is geopolitics. And what do you think is going on? It seems like markets are completely ignoring it. As you mentioned, S&P is at record highs, credit spreads are at multi-year lows. And for instance, if previously Israel attacked Doha, you would have seen a massive sell-off. And markets are shrugging it off, and not just that one instance, but over and over again this year. How are we calculating geopolitical risk nowadays?
Yeah, so I go back to how I started. Markets aren't the guardrails that you're looking for, right?
Again, the same way.
These are a series of events that I think are adding up. I do believe the markets are entirely too dismissive of this risk. Geopolitics is a very difficult risk to manage from a portfolio standpoint, right? Because it's this fat tail risk, low probability, high impact. It's there's not a great hedge per se. The way you hedge is just running lower risk. And that's precisely what we're doing. And so, it's a combination of this geopolitical landscape. I see it very similar to, you know, kind of the early 1930s, winds of war, I'm calling it, where you're seeing these regional sphere of influences being set between East and West, this nation state kind of philosophy. And, you know, I see geopolitical risk really quite high here and continuing to be quite high. And so what that means to me, particularly given where valuations are, is that investors should not be running high levels of risk, even if you are pretty constructive around the potential AI productivity boom at all. I just think the tail risk is just too high.
And it's interesting that you sort of compare this time to 1930s, because once again, even in our trade policy is very echoing similarly, right? Like we've having the highest tariffs since Smoot-Hawley, the whole idea of raising up tariff barriers rather than promoting open free trade. How are you looking at tariffs? I know we haven't seemed to have seen much of it and its an impact. Is it something that you're expecting later in the year, or are companies are going to be able to pretty much swallow these and move on?
Well, the question is, do they want to swallow that cost to move on? Our sense in talking with hundreds of companies is that they will not, that cost will be passed on.
Okay.
So just because it hasn't happened today in Moss doesn't mean it will not happen. If you parse out the latest inflation data, of course, we missed the last one,
yes,
but the one before that, you are seeing the impact of tariffs in the inflation data. So I expect that to continue. And I think all else equal, that will serve as a tax. That's what it is ultimately. And that will ultimately hurt margins or the consumer. The consumer is a very kind of K-shaped type of consumer segment, and it has a disproportionate effect on the lower consumer. So I think this story has yet to play out, but the real question is, how will that be offset with, the stimulus coming down the pike, the big beautiful bill, and additional kind of Fed stimulus. So we'll see. It's an open question, but make no mistake, the tariff will be a tax, and that will, hurt growth, not help growth.
And but even though it's hurting growth, we do expect to see more growth, right? To your point, you have a higher tilt towards overheating than to a recession. And forecasters are upgrading their growth projections. And corporations seem robust and healthy. And yet, Greg, there's a bifurcation among not just the consumers, but also among corporations, among the strong and the weak. Lately, we had some defaults that happened very suddenly. What are your expectations for defaults? What is the shape of some of the weaker element of our corporate borrowers?
Yeah, there's tremendous fragility in the system. One of the comments we continue to make is, you look at just kind of the high yield bond market as a proxy, right? So, high yield spreads are kind of the richest decile that we've seen over the past, just call it 30 years. So the kind of the top-down view of risk is actually quite favorable, right? If you think about spreads being reflective of the risk in the market. What you're seeing, however, underneath is a lot of volatility. Companies are struggling. You're seeing really wide dispersion. That's something that we're very focused on within the high yield bond market. And you're seeing, companies, both public and private, defaulting at a higher rate than you would expect given the macro backdrop, right? So why is that? Well, there's still a hangover effect from COVID. There's a hangover effect from, zero interest rate policy, where these companies basically were, able to survive just given the low cost of capital. And that takes time to play out. So, as that cost of capital resets higher and certain segments of the economy are weaker than others, of course, you're seeing a higher incident of defaults. So I think it bears watching, and I don't expect it to subside. If anything, it just shows you how how knife's edge we are from a credit perspective, where it looks great, but underneath there's some, you know, there's some real fragility that you need to pay attention to.
And how do you find these companies? Do you, is there certain sectors that you're avoiding, or is a certain kind of profile that you are on the watch out for? How can you help us figure out which companies are going to be going to distress?
Yeah, so I mean, what's interesting about this cycle thus far is that it's not so sectorial driven, right? So it's not like telecom. It's not like energy. It, you know, typically what you see around kind of distress and default cycles is a very industry specific type of cycle. It's a little different this time in that, you know, I go back to the zero cost of capital idea, where that was across broad sectors, right? So it was everywhere. So what you're seeing is kind of the incident of default and distress kind of happening more broadly instead of so specific around sectors. That being said, there are sectors that are more susceptible. The chemical sector is a great example where basically they're battling kind of pricing from China, where there's, you know, dumping effectively. These are really hurting these types of companies. To state the obvious, more of the kind of the commodity cyclical side of the aisle is more susceptible. And then, you know, the story that has yet to play out, going back to tariffs, is that these supply chains are really complicated and difficult to figure out. And what I think you'll see over time is various parts of that supply chain being in some sort of distress. It just hasn't happened yet. So that's bears watching, and that's really around the industrial segment of the economy.
And we spent most of the time talking about the U.S., even though we started off with France. So if I could move your thoughts to Europe. This year, more than any other year, I think investors have been really enthused about Europe. One is just the idea of geographical diversity, but also there is expected spending by particularly Germany on infrastructure and defense, which I think is taking a little bit longer than perhaps people thought it would at the beginning of the year. Where do you like? What do you like about Europe, and where are you investing?
Yeah, so I mean, one shouldn't be surprised at kind of Germany being slow on the fiscal.
Right? That's been their whole mantra.
That's been a prevalent story for quite some time. So that shouldn't surprise anyone. That being said, the delta of where we were and possibly where we're going is quite positive from a fiscal spend standpoint. You know, Europe to us has been kind of a several-fold story, starting with valuations. Valuations have been cheaper in Europe than in the U.S. A lot of that had to do with the Russian invasion. There was a resetting of prices given that event. So, you know, we need to catch ourselves at times when we say geopolitics don't matter. They do, right? So if you think about just investment-grade corporates as a proxy, pre-Russia invasion of Ukraine, European IG would trade more richly, just call it 10 basis points or so, inside the U.S. And that moved all the way up to, 90 basis points cheap, and then kind of settled down to anywhere from, 20 to 40. And I'm not suggesting that we go back to zero anytime soon necessarily, but it just showed you how the geopolitical side has really affected valuation. So we felt that was an opportunity just from a pure valuation standpoint. The second piece had to do with, the ECB. The ECB, we felt, was poised to be more proactive than the Fed, just given the inflation dynamics. Goes back to inflation, of course. And so that would be supportive of both sovereign risk and credit risk. The economy in Europe continues as it always, which is a muddling along. And muddle is very good for credit.
That's true, right? We don't need superstar. We don't need breakouts, right? We just need to get your money back.
It's the quintessential Goldilocks. Mm-hmm. Not too hot, not too cold. Just kind of muddles good, okay. You know. And Europe muddles. And so you put that all together, and we were, you know, pretty biased towards Europe going into this year. We have pared that back, just given kind of the move that we've seen. But there's still some value there vis-a-vis the U.S., but not as much as it used to.
So it's fine because Europe is not enjoying this AI data center boom that the U.S. has, right? This CapEx spending that has just caught people by surprise and just the huge amounts of checks that are being written and the spending and the investment. But since all you need is muddle through, it's okay.
Absolutely, yeah. And so that's a... You know, great comment, though. You know, the AI boom is decidedly U.S. focused. You know, there's lots of questions of whether, you know, it's a bubble or not. I think it's too early to tell. But, you know, what we're seeing from an opportunity set to invest in AI type of structures, namely data centers, you know, we feel like it's a very, very big opportunity. And not only that, you know, there's a real potential to take the U.S. on a different growth plane through productivity and kind of bringing it back to productivity, growth, and debt sustainability, right? If you adjust growth by, you know, 50 basis points, do the productivity per annum, and take that out to, 2055, debt to GDP would drop from 156% to 113%.
Wow.
Just based on CBO estimates. So that's a very big change. Mm-hmm. And that's what the U.S. has in spite of all these other policies we talked about, tariffs at all. This could be a real game changer from a growth perspective. And then relatedly to a debt sustainability perspective. Europe doesn't have that potential.
So... would that be your favorite trade? Because that's what I'm going to ask you next. With all the, because you're the global CIO and you invest in a lot of different asset class all around the world. What is your favorite trade? Is this the data centers or is it something else?
Gosh, I feel so straight down the fairway with data centers. But I do think it's really interesting and an investment that we like a lot. But all data center risk is not created equally, not surprisingly. The area of the market that we're focused is on the construction side. It's more controllable. What I worry about and what we worry about is obsolescence, right? So, you know, I was struck by some of the deals in the market with 40-year debt. You know, Oracle brought a deal a couple of weeks ago and included 40-year that kind of help finance some of that type of spend. And that kind of made me scratch my head a little. When you can invest in a data center build and pick up, you know, call it 175 basis points and effectively have the same risk with security. So there's a lot to do in that sphere. And consequently, you know, we do like that and like that a lot. So, yeah, I'll give it as my favorite trade.
Okay, because you're not saying private credit, because I've had a lot of guests here whose favorite trade is private credit. I know you do private and public. So we can move into that. It is outside of data centers and IE, the next most popular thing might be private credit. Tell me your view about it and how are you investing with the idea that markets are becoming more private?
Yeah, I mean, private credit isn't a trade, right?
That's true.
That's an asset class. So, I mean, I think that's part of the problem, honestly, is that there's no discernment between different types of private assets and private credit. They're not all created equally. You know, the way we're approaching the private credit sphere is, I would say, a more honest assessment. I think, you know, just talking about private credit with these unbelievably positive and high Sharpe ratios is doing yourself a disservice. Is it just a byproduct of, you know, not being marked or slow marks, and that's not really the volatility that asserts itself. So I think you need to make an adjustment for that when you think about private credit in a broader portfolio context. That's what we do. You know, we think it makes more sense. But, you know, there's parts of private credit that we think are fully valued, and you're not getting paid for the illiquidity premium, which matters, and other parts that, you know, we feel like you are. So just kind of thinking about it, you know, kind of broadly and obliquely, you know, the asset-based finance side of private credit is an area that we like and like a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's an area of the credit markets as well, where you gain access to credit where you ordinarily can't. You know, oftentimes going into a private deal, let's say in the auto parts sector, you know, isn't a diversifier per se, right? You're highly tied to the cyclicality of that sector. There's not a true diversification other than one gets marked more frequently than the other, right? So I think that's a fallacy. But when you move into asset-based finance, you get access to the consumer in ways that you don't get access otherwise. You get access to data center builds that you don't get access otherwise, you know, and these types of, you know, lending arrangements. So that's the area that we really like. So that's probably my second favorite idea, is the ABF space more broadly within the private credit sphere.
So now that I've asked you what your favorite trade is, I'm just going to also ask you what your biggest worry is, because you're a credit guy, and there isn't a credit guy worth his salt doesn't worry about not just one thing, but many things. But if you're going to tell me the one thing you're worried about.
Yeah, what I worry about is a resurgence in inflation.
What we started off talking about earlier,
You know, I think investors have been too quick to dismiss the end of inflation. And then kind of related to that is the Fed credibility around inflation. So that's the ultimate 1-2 punch that I worry about. So if you accept the premise that the economy will, you know, run hotter next year, just given, you know, everything that we talked about, then, you know, inflation will likely rise in that type of scenario. And then if there's moves where investors start to be concerned around the credibility and the independence of the Fed, then the untethering of inflation expectations, which is tantamount to credibility, if that goes away, then, you know, that could be a real risk factor for the market. So that's the one worry that I have. Well, I have many worries, but that's one that I probably fret the most.
And then this question, I think, is a little different than your favorite trade, because favorite trade is about valuation and about making money. But right now, as you look at your job, what is most exciting to you? Every market's different. Every firm is going through different things. So you personally, as an investor, excites you about investing at this moment in time? And I'll even make you make the rest of the year.
Yeah, I'm really excited around this public-private convergence. I feel like you know, investors have been entirely too siloed. They've given up the relative value nature of credit investing. It's, you know, I've been in middle market direct lending silo. I've been in large cap private credit. I've been in, you know, IG corporates. And there's never been a holistic look at credit as investors have just been filling those buckets independently and discreetly. And I personally think the opportunity set, not only today, but going forward, is kind of prosecuting those credit skills across public and privates and really extracting value for your portfolio and your clients. And that's the item that really excites me, as I don't think many people do it at all or well. So I think that's the opportunity and the thing I'm quite excited about.
Great. Thank you so much, Greg. This has been a really fun and fascinating conversation. I really appreciate the time you spent with me.
No, thanks for having me. It's been great.
And to our audience, thank you for listening. And do join us next week for another edition of Credit Exchange. And do follow us on Apple and Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. This has been Lisa Lee.